This podcast is brought to you by PLI, the Practicing Law Institute. PLI is committed to keeping you ever current on the dynamic trends shaping the legal world. Learn more at pli.edu/ftpod.
Welcome to Fast Tracked, Emergent Issues in the Legal Profession, brought to you by the Practicing Law Institute. I'm your host, Jen Leonard, founder of Creative Lawyers. Buckle up as we hit the gas and explore the most dynamic trends shaping the legal world, from generative AI to DE&I and everything in between. I hope you'll join us as we explore the future of law today. Hi there, and thanks for joining us on Fast Tracked. On today's episode, we hear from Karen Stacey, founder and CEO of Diversity Lab, and Shelley Smith, Chief Diversity Officer and partner with Archer & Griner, about the past, present, and future of DE&I initiatives in the law. I hope you enjoy this insightful discussion. Welcome, everybody, back to the Fast Tracked podcast. I'm your host, Jen Leonard, here to talk about all of the dynamic forces in the legal profession and how they are converging to create a time of exciting and challenging change. And I'm thrilled on each episode to be joined by two experts in our given topic. And this episode, we are talking all about diversity, equity, and inclusion in our profession. And I'm absolutely delighted today to be joined by two of my favorite thought leaders in this space, Shelley Smith and Karen Stacey. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for being on the Fast Tracked podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Same here.
So I want to start with a really open-ended question. And Shelley, I'm going to start with you. I would just love, there's so much happening in the diversity, equity, and inclusion space and has been for a while now. But where we sit today, how would you describe the current state of DE&I in the legal profession?
I want to try to come up with an appropriate adjective. Determined, I think, is a good one. As you know, certainly, I know Karen knows, and many of your listeners probably know, last summer, the Supreme Court issued its decision in the Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard and North Carolina cases, which ruled that the admissions programs at Harvard and the University of North Carolina, which tried to increase diversity at those schools, were unconstitutional. And although those decisions were decided in the context of college admissions and evaluated statutes that apply to public universities, so statutes on the Constitution, which applied to public universities, right on the heels of that decision, there was a lot of activity from antagonists towards DEI. There, Senator Tom Cotton sent letters to law firms around the country threatening their own diversity initiatives, as well as their support of their clients' diversity initiatives, which is also kind of remarkable when you think about it, threatening congressional intervention and, you know, to really, in an effort to intimidate law firms away from the diversity initiatives that they've undertaken for many, many years now to try to increase the diversity of attorneys at law firms. And after that, there were lawsuits filed by a group that is associated with the same instigator of the Harvard and UNC cases, challenging law firm diversity fellowship programs that basically offered scholarships or fellowships to law students who were from underrepresented backgrounds. Some of the programs that were targeted had language that specifically identified characteristics of underrepresentation as the criteria, and that was really the thing that was being targeted. But many, many firms have those kinds of fellowships, and the language varies from firm to firm. And so that certainly also made law firms uneasy. But what I've seen in the face of all of that, really, among the law firms, both not only my firm, but the firms in Philadelphia that we communicate with. We're a member of the Philadelphia Diverse Lawyers Group, PDLG, which is, you know, a collection of a number of the major law firms in Philadelphia who all work on, which works on diversity initiatives. And all of the firms are probably even more committed. Our firm president has called it doubling down, more committed, if that's possible, than they were before to making sure that this worked, because they recognize, we all recognize how important it is to diversify the legal profession, to continue to increase the diversity of the legal profession, and to expand that diversity into the leadership ranks of law firms. Because for one thing, the more diverse the legal profession continues to be, the more that diversity expands into the senior ranks of law firms and managing partners and shareholders and equity partners, the less likely you are to have a decision like the Harvard case, frankly, because the Supreme Court pulls from law firms, right? Or, you know, the path to the Supreme Court goes through a number of these places. And the more diversity there is, the more diverse the pool is for justices, and the more diverse ultimately the judiciary is. And then you have a different perspective on the need for these kinds of programs and the historical perspective that led to the rationale for supporting these kinds of programs in the first place. So from my perspective, where we are now is really digging in to try to figure out how we can maintain the programs and continue the momentum, whatever momentum we've had, to make them work and to increase diversity.
So determined, for sure. And that definitely tracks a lot of the news coverage I've been following about firms' reaffirmed commitment and corporate counsel's commitment to increasing the push for diversity in the profession. And Karen, of course, you work very closely with all of these stakeholders in helping them drive inclusion in their organizations. What would you add to Shelley's good points there?
Yeah, Shelley is absolutely right. Firms and corporations have stayed committed. And we have several demonstratives from Diversity Lab's perspective. So not one of the 360 plus law firms that are pursuing Mansfield Rule certification have backed out or backtracked. Not one of the 40 some odd legal departments who work with us to collect data and partner with their outside counsel to create inclusive teams have backed out or backed away from talking to their law firms about creating inclusive and diverse teams. So we're seeing in the marketplace everybody holding on tight to the work that they're doing. But I will say, and I know Shelley mentioned this too, you know, what this feels like is a shock and awe campaign by anti-DEI activists. And it's politicized. It's incredibly politicized. But the downside of that shock and awe campaign is that it has created fear and distraction. And a lot of companies and law firms, even though they're pushing forward with diversity, equity, and inclusion work, they're doing so somewhat more quietly than they've done in the past. And I think, you know, now is the time that we need to be loud and proud, because otherwise the anti-DEI activists control the narrative. And we're sitting in the back, you know, quietly defending the work that we're doing, but we really need to be loud and proud about the work that we're doing. And I will suggest there are two silver linings to this. And look, I'm a pretty optimistic person, so I had trouble finding these silver linings, even with my high level of optimism. But I have seen two things happen as a result of the Supreme Court ruling, which, as Shelley mentioned, you know, legally, that does not affect the work we're doing in private employers. So nothing changed as a result of the Supreme Court ruling for corporations and for law firms. But that ripple effect with the anti-DEI activists certainly created that shock and awe. But the two silver linings are, one, everybody is in fact stepping back and reflecting on what they're doing and how they're doing it, which is never a bad thing. The second thing is, you know, that's the saying, I'm from Texas. So, you know, we're separating the wheat from the chaff on this. We're going to truly see which leaders and which organizations are committed to creating inclusive workforces. Because if this scares people and they backtrack, we're going to know it didn't align with their values in the first place. And we're going to know that they're not willing to take the risk of fighting a lawsuit or dealing with, you know, the court of public opinion on these things. So I'm anxious to see if there are some people who say they value this, but ultimately are scared away. And if that's the case, good riddance to you. But I want to keep the people in the fold who care about this. And also the people who are silent detractors or who don't see the good work we're doing, I want to bring them into the fold in this time so that they can start to understand that maybe they have some misconceptions about what we're doing and how we're doing it. But if they don't care about diversity, equity, and inclusion, I'm okay with letting them, you know, go do something else.
I also think that the great work that Diversity Lab does with Mansfield has created a community of people who communicate about these issues all the time. And that community, I think, also has enabled smaller subsets of that, of the community within, you know, the within, I think, the legal profession in whatever region you're operating. So PDLG is an example that I gave. It predates Mansfield, but I think all the firms in PDLG, I think, are Mansfield certified. And one of the things that has happened that I think has been really good is that we've all really started communicating about, because diversity is not, it doesn't have to be a competition in the same way that we sort of maybe more generically compete for talent or whatever. Our diversity initiatives really complement each other's at every firm. And so we are communicating, I think, more than, so I've been in this position for 3 years now, and we are communicating as diversity professionals about diversity initiatives and sort of backing up and supporting and reconfiguring, if it's necessary, diversity efforts more than we have in the prior 2 years that I had this position since this decision happened. And I think that's a consequence of people wanting to band together, knowing that there are other people who are other firms that are doing this, other firms and organizations that are doing the same kind of work, having Mansfield to support it. One of the things that the Diversity Lab did very quickly after the decision was put out, you know, here's what your legal landscape really is. Like, don't, you know, don't be distracted by that shiny, ugly thing over there, because here's what the real, the applicable law is. And so, you know, to have that kind of a resource as you fold it into your own resources to analyze what you're doing is really helpful. And I think having the community of people who are still committed to it really helps, as Karen said, separate the wheat from the chaff, understand who really is committed. You know, there was a program we were trying to figure out, you know, what corporate people can we, because it's important, it's still important to, in the corporate community as well, wanted corporate people to talk about that, needed panelists for corporate people. And you could tell, you know, some people were like, yep, I'll do it. Here I am. Let me know when it is. And other people were like, yeah, let me see. Not sure I want to talk about it, even though they might still be committed. And so it is going to shake some of that out. And, but having the community band together to reinforce the importance of these initiatives, I think will be helpful to ultimately allowing us all to be louder and prouder about what we're doing. At least that's what I hope, because I too am an optimist. So, and you know, the other thing is just as a matter of demographic fact, people aren't going away. People aren't going away. You know, all of the new lawyers are not going to be white men, white Christian men. They're just not. So that's just fact. So eventually, you know, the progress will continue to be made, hopefully.
Yes.
Ultimately.
And I think the data, I know the data bears that out society-wide, but also I think NALP data on incoming law firm associates showed 2 years ago, 52% of incoming associates identified as attorneys of color or attorneys who have been historically in marginalized groups. And so to your point, Shelley, that is the future of the profession. And we'll talk in a little bit about leadership and mentorship there. And Karen, I wanted to turn to you to see if you had something to add to Shelley's points there.
Yeah. So you made the mistake, Jen, of bringing up data. And then, you know, I started
drooling
and then had to add to me. I love data. So I want to make a point about the data because, you know, we measure representation and demographics as a way to show progress, as a way to show that, you know, that our profession reflects society. But Jen, you brought up a point about our law school classes, because that truly is our available workforce. And here's something that's interesting that people don't know, because I'm a big fan of progress begets progress. And people don't realize that we've seen an increase in underrepresented individuals going into law school and coming out of law school year over year over year for 10 and now 20 years. And we're starting to see the associate population mirror the law school population. And so we're doing a pretty good job of making sure that our associate workforce reflects the available workforce in law schools. And that's not to say we can't do better about making sure people have access to go to law school, but we have made inroads in reflecting the workforce that we have available to us. Where we're seeing the biggest gap is from associate to partner and from partner to somewhat to representation at the GC level in corporations. Because as Shelley and you have said, Jen, you know, law firms are a feeder for corporations. We're 38% of Congress. We're 10% of college provosts. We're 3 of 4 sports commissioners. So if we think about the importance of inclusivity and diversity in law, that populates the rest of the world. In fact, lawyers rule the world. So this data is really important. And to think about representing our workforce is really crucial to everything we're working for.
Absolutely. And I do just want to, for the listeners, go back to something Shelley invoked, which is the Mansfield certification program. And if there's a lawyer left in the profession who is not familiar with Mansfield certification, because it has been so impactful, I'd just like to take a moment and define it, Karen, and ask you to share with the audience what the Mansfield certification program is and what it measures.
Yeah, so the Mansfield certification really is based in science. And for anyone that is both a behavioral science and a data geek, you'll know Daniel Kahneman, who's an award-winning behavioral economist. He wrote a terrific book called Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow. And it's all about the idea that, you know, in our lives, we have 2 systems of thinking. And we enact system 1, which is fast thinking, all the time, right? If we're driving a car and we swerve without really thinking about it, that's system 1 thinking. But the problem is that often we use system 1 thinking when we should use system 2, slow thinking. So when we make talent decisions, for instance, like when we're reviewing resumes or when we're thinking about who to give work to or a really great high visibility opportunity, a lot of times we enact our system 1 thinking and bias just flows right into that, right? It's who did we talk to last? Who do we work with most? Who is most like us or who shares a lot of the same interests as us? And so Mansfield is based in the science that we need to move to our system 2 thinking, slow thinking. So it asks law firm leaders and really everyone in the organization to just stop and consider 30% underrepresented humans anytime you're appointing to leadership, electing to a leadership role like practice group leader, office managing partner, anytime you're putting a pitch together for clients. Anytime you're thinking about promotions to equity partner, slow down, broaden the network, open the door wider so more people are included in the consideration factor. We're not asking people to make hiring decisions. We're not asking people to make promotion decisions based on race, based on gender, or based on any of those things. We're merely asking everyone to step back, slow down, broaden the network of people who are being considered and are qualified for this role. The second thing we ask is that you make all of your processes and your job descriptions transparent. That way people know what it means to be qualified for that role and they understand how you get there. Because one of the biggest deterrents and one of the biggest barriers to entry is not understanding how those decisions are made and how people get there and who makes those decisions. And I'll just say this, because I want to turn it to Shelley since she lives and breathes Mansfield rule every day. But I will say that we measure the output. And the firms that have stayed committed longer than 3 years, it really does take a year to get all of these processes in place. It takes another year to really start to measure where you're seeing progress. But in 3 years, looking at that first group of law firms that signed on, they have doubled the diversity of their leadership. And there's that tangible, quantifiable result. But there's also, as Shelley said, the intangible qualitative result, which is the goal is to have our underrepresented lawyers have equal access to these opportunities and to feel included and then to be seen and visible as people are thinking about who the next set of leaders are in this organization. So Shelley, I'll turn it to you because you live and breathe this every day.
I was just going to say from the perspective of somebody who does live and breathe these issues, I think the great thing about Mansfield is that if you start with a law firm without any of these kinds of sort of interventions, right? An associate is hired by chance maybe or prior relationship, depending on the circumstances, they end up with a really good mentor. They end up with a really good sponsor. They end up with somebody who is looking out for them, making sure they get good assignments, making sure they get on committees if the opportunity, making sure they meet lucrative clients or have the opportunity to interact with any client so that they can help to build relationships and build their book of business. And as a result of that, they are put in front of people and meet more people, and the meeting more people provides them with other opportunities. And those other opportunities then ultimately position them to be considered in 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years for a partnership. And, you know, all of those client relationships that they may have had the opportunity to build then enable them to be considered for equity partnership. And the associate that that happens to in an ordinary situation may not really have any awareness of how any of these opportunities, yeah, just because they might have happened to have a conversation with a partner who happened to be influential, and that partner said, hey, I like you, come to this meeting with me. And it's all very incidental. And what Mansfield does is really force intentionality onto these processes, because otherwise they are not necessarily going to be intentional. You might have a rare person, a rare partner who is real intentional about it. But by and large, people work with the people they like. They want to like the people they work with. They interact with somebody and they strike up a conversation and they hit it off. And, you know, they go to that person to give them work. And it's all, you know, kind of very, I don't want to say haphazard, but it's happenstance. So Mansfield really forces intentionality onto those processes. It really makes you, because there are these consideration targets that we want to meet, we have to think about the opportunities that we're giving people. We have to think about the contact with clients that they're getting. We have to think about how they're getting work and who's giving them work and what kind of work they're getting and all of that stuff. And then, because Mansfield tracks the various consideration at the various stages, it forces people who are already in those positions of leadership and practice group leadership and relationship partner people, and to think about, how did I get here? Because that's the other thing that doesn't happen in a law firm, is people don't remember how they got where they are. It's true. It's probably not unique to law firms either, but they don't remember how they got where they were. They don't remember that when they were a law student fresh out of law school and came into work, some partner who happened to be down the hall said, hey, you know, you seem like you are on the ball here, come do this for me. And one thing led to another. And the next thing, you know, that, you know, 7 or 8 years later, that partner retired. And now you are the relationship partner. People don't remember that.
Shelly, I barely remember what I had for breakfast. So 100% exactly, you are correct. Right.
Exactly right. And so it forces people to think about, okay, well, how did this happen to me? What were the mechanics of how this worked for me? And how can we institutionalize those mechanics and make them intentional so that they benefit everybody? Because unless it's intentional, you still have the same people in leadership considering the same people who are not in leadership, and the same cycle goes round. What's that Joni Mitchell song? And the circle goes round and round and round, and it never changes. And so when you incentivize that kind of intentionality, then you help to broaden the decision making. You help to broaden the consideration of candidates and the pool of candidates, and that broadened consideration ultimately, as Karen said earlier, I think broadens the group of people in place to make decisions going forward. So then you have broadened the circle that is going round and round. And you've also institutionalized, hopefully anyway, institutionalized the intentionality of all of these decisions, so that now the people that you are bringing up behind you are intentional about what they're doing too. Because it really is, you know, Karen mentioned behavioral science earlier. It really is behavioral change. People, you know, otherwise left to their own devices, people do what they want to do, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, whether it's progressive or regressive, whatever it is, people do what they want to do. And sometimes you have to make them understand why maybe not doing what they would naturally automatically be inclined to do is not so bad.
No, and the intentionality and the data-driven approach that the Mansfield certification requires is really essential. And then, Shelley, just to put a very fine point on what you're saying, I think the education and awareness about behavioral change and some of the behavioral science Karen surfaced. I mean, even in my own life, as somebody who tries to be intentional about these things, I wasn't aware until the last decade, I would say, about affinity bias, and thought there was nothing wrong with saying, this reminds me of a younger version of me. I'd like to mentor them. And there isn't necessarily anything wrong with that. It's just, are you considering people who are different from you? And not only trying to reach out to your younger self, but trying to create space and opportunity for people that are different from you so that you can also learn from them as well. And so I think those three parts of the stool, the intentionality, the education and awareness, and the data around driving change is what makes Mansfield so impactful. And we're so grateful, Karen, for your leadership in creating such a creative and innovative approach, which is going to lead us into my favorite topic area, which is creativity and innovation. I think it's a skill set, a mindset, a set of techniques that our profession has not really leveraged historically. But both of you have shown me and others how we can use creativity to, Karen, I'm going to use another one of your projects, move the needle with respect to DE&I initiatives. So I'm going to come back to you, Karen, and just start and ask you to share just general thoughts about how creativity and innovation can be useful here, and then specific projects that you've used and tried and learned from. And then Shelley, I want to come back to you because I've also seen firsthand some of the creative approaches you have taken in leadership positions to move the needle.
So on the creativity front, it's primarily innovation and creativity drive most of what we do in Diversity Lab with the underpinnings of data and science. And we started by trying something creative called the On-Ramp Fellowship. And the idea was, you know, women leave the profession to raise children for a lot of reasons. But for whatever reason, we were putting a brick wall up and not allowing, you know, access back into the profession when and if they were ready. And I saw that, right? I was head of talent at Cooley and Arnold and Porter and Wahl Gotshal for 20 some odd years. And you know, not a week went by that I wouldn't get a resume from somebody, usually a woman, with a gap, a 5-year, a 10-year, and even a 20-year gap. And every time I would take that resume to a practice group leader, he or she would say, oh, you know, they have practiced for so long. The law has changed. It totally hasn't. Maybe how we deliver legal services has changed, but that's not something that's, you know, not teachable. And then they would say, well, how do we know if they left of their own volition? And how do we know they're good? And I would always think, we don't know that about laterals either, but okay. And so we started essentially running money balls to show that these women are going to bring something amazing. But if I need to show you proof, great, let's be creative in the proof that I show you. And what was so interesting about that is it was the first time I had ever run an experiment, and it's the first time I'd ever worked with law firms to run an experiment. And, you know, most lawyers are not risk adverse. And so experimentation and the fear of failure doesn't sit well normally with the vast majority of our population in the legal profession. But four law firms were willing to try it, and it succeeded. They hired 9 returning women, and they were like, wow, Karen, best thing since sliced bread. What else you got on the creative front? And so we started running hackathons. And it was really funny because I would say, like, I called Mitch, the head of ORIC, and said, I want to run this hackathon. You know, could you please give me a straight, white, non-disabled man to be in this hackathon so that we can hack inclusivity and equity? And his first question was, what's a hackathon? And his second question was, why'd you ask for that guy? It's because we need everybody involved in creating an inclusive environment. And it's because we need the creativity and the wicked smarts that each and every one of us bring to the table. And it turns out that, and the Mansfield rule came from a hackathon. So it turns out if you put a bunch of really smart lawyers in a room, you give them a design thinking framework to utilize, they can come up with marvelous ideas. And then those ideas to institutionalize inclusion, because they're their ideas, they are hell-bent on getting those ideas in place and making sure they work. So there is really nothing that Diversity Lab does that is our own ideas. We work with lawyers to create ideas that are going to create inclusive environments. And then we work with those lawyers whose ideas it was to put it in place in law firms and then to measure the results. And so I think, like, we were born out of creativity. And the second thing I'll say related to creativity is fun. Like, so much of what we do all day, every day is hard. So why not add a little bit of fun? And Jen, if we're able to, I'll give you a video that you can include in the materials, because Harvard Law School filmed our hackathons. And in it, you are going to see a group of 7 lawyers run in velour tracksuits. So that is all I'll say in terms of creativity and fun related to the hackathon, aside from the fact that they're impactful. And ideas like Mansfield Rule, on-ramp fellowship, and other things come from a creative place when you make space for that creativity.
I love everything that you just said. As you know, this is just an area of excitement and passion for me. But one thing I think the three of us also share is a real desire to help lawyers live healthier lives and enjoy their practices so that they can enjoy their lives, but also provide better service to their clients. But Karen, I will just echo what your experience was, because years ago, I would do well-being presentations for law students, and they were more educational content. And what I realized was, as I'm presenting to them about what their future lives are going to be like as lawyers, the anxiety level is just going up and up and up in the room, right? And I'm trying to be helpful to them, but I realize through an empathy lens that that is a very, very stressful thing to sit and listen to. So then I went back to the drawing board and thought, well, what if we did an innovation tournament with the students and presented them with some of this content, but then said, like, how would you attack this? How would you change this if you were a law firm managing partner? And all the anxiety goes away because it's channeled into the fun that lawyers have in problem solving and coming up with, which is what we do all the time for our clients, right? But it is amazing how magical it is when you flip that lens from just being anxious or risk averse or afraid of everything to, all right, well, let's attack it, come up with some solutions. And Shelley, in addition to your current role with Archer and Griner, you also served as city solicitor to the city of Philadelphia for 8 years, which is the chief civil legal officer for the city and its many departments and agencies. And I had an opportunity to watch you do many creative things to try to increase inclusion, particularly with outside counsel that the city would use to support its legal work. And I'd love if you would be willing to share what I saw as a very creative approach to solving a problem that previously had seemed intractable.
Sure. So the city obviously has innumerable civil legal conflicts of various kinds. And while it has a full-size public law firm representing it, and you know, it's an office of about 200 lawyers and another 125 or so support staff, there are still legal problems, significant legal problems that it can't handle on its own because it doesn't have the expertise or it needs greater staffing or whatever it is. And, you know, for years, the law department was under a lot of, or received some criticism for not diversifying the lawyers that do that work. And because the law department is a city department like other city agencies, it has to go before city council for its budget, and city council would annually ask questions about the demographics of lawyers within the law department and the demographics of law firms representing the law department by contract. And so the city also, probably like many other clients who hire lawyers, has had a history of retaining the same lawyers or the same law firms over many, many years over time. And so to try to diversify that, the city, because it's public, also had some minority business requirements that it had to comply with. So in order to try to increase the diversity while getting the kind of legal service that the city often needed for very sophisticated, very complicated, very long, drawn out legal matters, which can typically only be handled by law firms who don't, don't always have responsible partners or whatever who are from underrepresented groups. We worked with the Commerce Department, which runs the minority business aspect of that process, to create a criterion that would give law firms credit under the minority business guidelines for assigning the work to underrepresented lawyers and for having the responsible partner on the business with the city be a lawyer from an underrepresented group. And I'm not sure how much that was happening at the time. After we did it, then the Commonwealth followed suit and was even more aggressive about it. But this was to sort of recognize that we needed law firms. Part of what I was trying to do was make sure that we didn't contract with outside counsel unless we absolutely needed it, first of all. So when we absolutely needed it, we needed it in situations where the matter was really complex, like labor negotiations that would go on for years and years and have lots of briefing and need lots of staffing and things that we really could not handle most of the time because we didn't have the staffing to handle it and we needed the resources of a large firm. And also recognizing that the way that lawyers ascend in a law firm is to have relationship credit, responsible credit for matters that have significant billing, clients that have significant billing. So combining those two things, we worked with the Office of Minority Business or whatever it was called to allow us to get credit under the minority business guidelines for retaining firms whose responsible partner for our work and the lawyers assigned to the work were from underrepresented groups. And that really did help start to make some inroads in that process and remind the firms that it was important to the city, which is, you know, in Philadelphia, the education, government, and healthcare are the biggest employers, right? So we're also the biggest hirers of lawyers, of law firms. And it's important, even though the fees tend to be lower, it's important to law firms, to the big law firms in the city. It was sort of more important than the fees have been reduced so much that the calculus is a little bit different now. But it was important to the firms to be able to do business with the city because they wanted to have a role in that. And it was important to us to have big firms doing it because it sends a signal to the courts about the significance of the matters that they're working on. So it helped to incent those firms to assign underrepresented lawyers to manage our matters and helped them to build their book of business.
Karen, did you have something you wanted to add there? I thought I saw your finger, but maybe
that. Yes, I'll just add that, Shelley, I think you did two things that were remarkable, especially at the time. You were way ahead of what folks were doing at the time, and I think now hopefully have learned from what you've done. I would highlight two things you said. One is, you didn't just ask about the makeup of the team. You asked about the economic elements that influence what happens with that lawyer's career trajectory and whether or not they're able to make and sustain partner. Financial credit, leadership roles, all of those things are hugely important. And oftentimes clients just ask about the makeup of their team. And sometimes law firms can show the data in a way that it turns out that the vast majority of the team from a historically underrepresented standpoint are the junior lawyers, maybe working on e-discovery, but maybe they're not the lawyers in leadership leading the cases or getting financial credit. So one, I think that's remarkable that you expanded it more than just the makeup of the team to that leadership. The second thing I'll say, and look, we know there's lots of folks in the law firm and legal department environment who believe that having more inclusive and equitable environments is important. But we also know that there are those who maybe they believe it's important, but maybe they're not making it a priority. The minute their client tells them it's a priority, it becomes their priority. So whether they believe in it and it's part of the makeup and the fabric of their lives, and or because a client asked them to be more intentional and thoughtful, I'll take either. So, Shelley, kudos to you and all of the legal departments and corporations who are pushing on their legal service providers because that's made real progress. And Jen moved the needle in law in ways that we've seen a pretty remarkable turn.
I also one other thing, to your point, Karen, about being important, when it's important to the clients, it becomes important to the firms. When I first started doing that, there were firms that I had to call and say, they would have gone through a process and, you know, whatever our internal selection process was, interviewing the firms and whatever. And, you know, before or when we made a decision, you know, there were occasions when I had to call the firm and say, before we make a determination about whether we can retain your firm to do this work, I want to make sure you understand that I want this person, this woman, this underrepresented person, whatever, to be the responsible partner. Like, you brought the person into the, you know, the person participated in the meeting and the conversation about what the firm brought to the table or whatever it was. So I want to make sure that you understand that this would be a condition of us retaining you, all other things being equal, because sometimes you have to, sometimes it's not like you have to be really clear, or the firms don't, they think they can wiggle around with it and not take your, and this was then, not maybe not so much now, but this was then, you know, the firms sort of thought maybe they could kind of go, yeah, okay, these people are here in the room with you, but when we get back to the office, you know, we're going to make some different arrangement. And I wanted to make sure, because I had spent a couple of years at a firm, so I had some awareness of what they did internally. And I wanted to make clear that I know what you're, I know how you do what you do. And I want to make sure that this is how it's going to work if we select you, because it's important to us that that's what happened. So I did have to have those conversations early on, because I wanted to make sure that they took those requirements seriously.
And Shelley, I'd love to stay there with you too, and move back into the law firm internal dynamics and leadership, and ask you about leadership and diversity in leadership generally, and why it matters. Some of the conversations you've had leading associates, I think we all feel like on a gut level, diversity and leadership matters, but on a really concrete level, why does it?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I've been, so, you know, in the work that I've been doing and sort of working with the Mansfield criteria and kind of understanding what our diversity challenges have been, one of the things that's become very clear is that retention is a huge part of this. And we have to work on the things that impact retention, because you can hire, we and many firms, and Karen made this point a little while ago, do a great job of hiring underrepresented lawyers, but then you look around, it's like, you know, it's like they would tell you on your first day of law school, look to your right, look to your left, one of these people won't be here when you, if you graduate, one of these people won't be here with you, right? It's, you know, it's a little bit of the same thing, that you can bring in as many diverse lawyers as you want, but then you want to make them stay because it's, or not make them stay, but you want to encourage them to stay because it's not just about diversifying the profession, which is what, you know, sometimes people say, well, you know, everything that we do helps to diversify the profession. Yes, diversifying the profession is great. But you know, Jenna, somebody who worked in government, that there are parts of the legal profession that are very diverse, and then there are parts that are not. And so if we were going to succeed in, you know, really maintaining and pursuing our commitment to diversity, we really had to focus on retention. And so we've been trying to focus on things like mentoring and professional development to make sure that we are identifying the barriers that might exist that people might not even recognize to the path that an attorney follows to ascend to partner. Is it transparent? Is it clear? Are all similarly situated lawyers getting what they need? Not the same thing, but the equitable solutions to those things. What, you know, Associate A may need a different set of, different kind of support or different kind of criticism or different whatever than Associate B might need for a whole variety of reasons. And that applies to everybody, not just underrepresented groups. But when you look at it for everybody, you can figure out whether there are particular barriers to lawyers from underrepresented groups. And so we've been looking at mentoring and, you know, trying to make sure that we are creating an environment where mentor-mentee relationships can develop organically, but also have a structure in place around that to ensure that there is a relationship somewhere, right? Because sometimes when you assign a mentor-mentee relationship one-on-one, if those two people get along, then don't get along, then the mentoring fails, right? Because one person's not, you know, doing whatever their share of the relationship is. And so, in sort of asking questions about how it's working and what, you know, in what kind of feedback do you get? And I did a talk to a reporter from the Legal Intelligencer last week who was asking about supervision, because there's this lawsuit against Troutman Pepper, I think it is. I can't remember, one of the big law firms, where an associate is claiming that the supervision, that the criticism that she got was somehow discriminatory. And so after the article came out, you know, I got some feedback from associates, and they said, you know, one of the most important things, if you're going to get feedback that's credible, it helps to have diverse leadership in place, supervisors and practice group leaders and people who are in roles of authority within the firm, for there to be more of those people from underrepresented groups, because the more diverse the leadership is, the more credible then any criticism that an associate gets becomes, because then they're hearing it from people who are in an environment where they're sensitive to, you know, whatever the differences might be, or people who are different from themselves. They're just kind of viewed as more aware. And so obviously part of training lawyers to be good lawyers and good firm members and all of those things is to be able to provide them with constructive criticism that they will then turn around and apply in a way that helps to improve their practice. But if your criticism is not credible, then your criticism is going to fall on deaf ears. And so it's important for all of us to recognize that, you know, if you are managing young lawyers and those young lawyers are diverse, and it doesn't appear that you are in an environment that is similarly diverse, you know, they're kind of going to be like, well, you know, how do you even know what you're talking about when you're talking to me? They're just, because, you know, I think we've all become sort of more sensitive and aware to, you know, we talk about microaggressions and it's the sort of cultural differences and things like that. And it's not necessarily about that specifically, but it's just about the awareness of how to interact with people who might have a different background from you or might have a different perspective from you for a variety of reasons. And the more diversity in the group of people that is supervising and managing your team, the better that, the more credible that criticism is going to be.
And of course, Shelley, I'm going to say yes and add some data to the mix, because I cannot help myself. Everything you said, I think, is so spot on, and the data supports it. We've run data to look at law firms and corporations. And when we see corporations and law firms who have more diverse leaders, they tend to have more inclusive decision-making, and they tend to have more inclusive talent practices, which leads to a more diverse workforce. And so, you know, not only is it important for all of the reasons that you mentioned, but if you have a diverse group of people sitting around a table, when they're thinking about leave, they're likely thinking about leave in a much more broad way if there's a woman with a child or a single man who doesn't have a child, or any number of different ways to look at something adds value to how you make those decisions and ultimately what the final decision is about your talent practice. So we've narrowed our focus at Diversity Lab on diversifying leadership so that the decisions that are being made are more inclusive and equitable.
Yeah. And it really, you know, pays such dividends in so many different ways, as both of you have mentioned. I've spent the last 10 years on a law school campus, and law students are very accustomed to being part of a very diverse community. And for many of them, it's shocking when they arrive at a law firm and they don't see that diversity reflected in the leadership. And it's really important to them that they see people who represent their experiences as well, because Shelley, to your point, there's a lot more trust there that they are joining an organization that cares about promoting them and making sure that they have a path toward success as well. Shelley.
Yeah, that point you made, Jen, is so important. I think that not only law students are accustomed to being in a diverse environment, but I think most of us, I live in a metropolitan East Coast area, so it might be, maybe it's more unique. You're not really supposed to modify unique, but maybe it's more common in this region and on the West Coast. But I think most of us are accustomed to operating in the rest of the world in a fairly diverse environment. And then, you know, for anybody then to come into a law firm, which is so different in that way from what the rest of the world is. I mean, your neighborhood, anybody's neighborhood is, well, not anybody's neighborhood, but most people's neighborhoods are likely more diverse than almost any law firm. And so it's kind of like law firms can often be sort of the last place that isn't a microcosm of society, because society has become so much more diverse. And, you know, it's A really good example of this is like a couple of years ago, we did, as part of our diversity programming, we did a program on pronouns. And we had, in our firm, we have a diversity committee, which is partners, but we also have diversity advocates who are anybody who is interested in working on those issues. And so that's associates and support staff and anybody who's interested. And so a couple of associates wanted to do a program on pronouns. And they explained, it's also natural to them. They were, you know, first year, fourth year associate, something like that. So such a kind of natural, normal thing for them to talk about. They explained why it's important to people to have, you know, to make your pronouns clear. And, you know, there certainly are more senior people in our firm, in, you know, the legal profession that I talked to that are like, why do I need to worry about this? But that's a really good example. Like the young people are operating in such a different world than those of us who are, as somebody put it yesterday at a meeting I was, more seasoned. And we really have to be mindful of that because they are the future of our profession. And so we, you know, like it or not, people have to recognize that, you know, that is the direction. And so, you know, we have to work towards making law firms more like real life.
Well, you are two of my favorite people with whom to think about the future. You have both been blazing trails for so long now, and it's really, really exciting to see how much the profession has changed in my 20 years of being a lawyer, largely as a result of the efforts of both of you and many others who are really growing experiments and programs and lifting up the next generation to make sure that 20 years from now, we're having much better conversations about diversity and inclusion. So I want to thank both of you for spending your precious time with us and educating our audience about all of these issues. And I want to thank everybody for joining us on the podcast. We hope you will join us for future episodes of the Practicing Law Institute's Fast Tracked Conversation. Thank you for joining us on Fast Tracked. I hope you enjoyed this fascinating conversation as much as I did. Visit pli.edu for more insights, education, and resources for navigating this dynamic landscape. And until next time, stay curious and stay adaptable as we work together to chart a course into an exciting future.